Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street. It's great to be back. Thanks for joining us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming in the second half of today's show, a North Dakota soldier longs for Juneberries, a tribal mobile clinic rolls through rural Nevada, fireflies flash for love, and century-old hydropower plants fight to stay online.
Flying, chasing every beam of sunlight. We're running after all the color. Galaxies we will discover. Up above the ground, reaching for starlight.
Welcome to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. This summer, a team from the University of North Dakota Aviators soared into the history books. For the first time ever, the UND Frozen Force Flying Team has won the Intercollegiate Division of the prestigious Air Race Classic, a grueling multi-day competition that pits the nation's top female collegiate pilots against each other in a test of precision, planning, and endurance. The 2025 race took them from Fairhope, Alabama to Spokane, Washington, and now they've touched back down in Grand Forks as champions. With us today are Helena Lind. She's a pilot, a senior commercial aviation and airport management major. Charlotte Fuller, she was a co-pilot and is a commercial aviation major graduating in August. Caroline Kelly, she was the navigator and she graduated with a degree in commercial aviation and aviation safety and operations. And she is still an instructor at UND. And Aubrey Barrell, she's just completed her freshman year. Her major is commercial aviation and aviation management. To all of you, welcome. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
You're sure welcome. We're really glad that you're with us and congratulations. Why are you named the Frozen Force? Where did that come from?
So as everyone knows, North Dakota is probably one of the most northern in the United States. We're very close to Canada. So we picked the name Frozen Force. It's been the name for quite some time for the Air Race Classic team. And we've kind of just continued on for it because it's something we're proud of. We come from a place where we fly in cold temperatures all the time. So yeah.
Now, Helena, you were the pilot, correct?
Yes. Yes, I was.
So what does that mean for you? Are you in charge of the team, so to speak? Are you all working together in your own roles or how is everything organized?
Yeah, so it's very team effort wise. As pilot, I do try to delegate and kind of lead the team in the direction. But this year we had such a great team that we all had equal voices, equal play into our decision making throughout the team. So honestly, it was a team effort. I cannot take any of that credit.
Charlotte, you were the co-pilot, correct?
Yes, I was the co-pilot.
And this route was from Alabama to Washington. How long did it take? Take me inside the cockpit, if you would, please. What were you flying?
So it's technically a four-day race, but we had some weird circumstances this year with some bad weather storms down in Alabama. So getting to the start, we woke up super early that morning. We're super excited. We got to the airport. We got all our briefings done. And then we found out that the first leg was canceled. So that being said, they then changed and said that we were going to skip that first stop in Starksville and go right to Boone County, Arkansas. And they told us to get there however we felt safe and necessary. And then the race would start when we got there. So technically our four-day race moved into a three-day race. And we got to Boone County, Arkansas, and then that's when we began. And then we had 3 days to get from Boone County to Spokane, Washington. So before the race started, we did something called a handicap flight, where a handicap pilot goes up with us in our aircraft, and we get a set ground speed for the RPM setting that we use. So we use 2,500 because we're in the EDMA category. And for other aircraft, that would be full power. And then we get that ground speed, which is our speed over the ground. And then we use that and we're trying to beat that speed the whole race. So we take those 3 days and we change things like our weight, the winds, the altitude, center of gravity, and we try to get as fast as we can. And so every aircraft is trying to beat their own speed.
What airplane were you flying?
We were flying the Piper Archer this year.
And is that similar across everyone else who was competing? Were you all flying the same plane?
No, so we're actually one of the slowest planes in the race, which is kind of crazy in the fact that we won, but everyone flies different planes. So there's a lot of general aviation women out there who just take their own planes. The other schools take their training aircraft. So there's tons of different planes that fly in the race.
The reason why we have that handicap flight that Charlotte described was because everyone's flying different planes. So if it was based on whoever was the fastest performing aircraft would get there first, which is why we have that handicap flight.
Sure. Caroline, what was your role as a navigator? In today's, with modern tech as it is, I mean, planes are almost autonomous in some ways, but what was your role?
Right. So as the navigator, my biggest role was just to support Helena and Charlotte in the front seat and just give them whatever they need, whether that was in-flight snacks or water or whatever that was. And then also I helped brief them on what was coming up in our route. So we have to do certain, a very specific flyby at each airport that we land at. And so just making sure that we were all aware of what was coming up next in our flights.
And Aubrey, what was your role in charge of ground management for the team?
Yeah, so I was the ground coordinator this year. The other three fly the race, and then I stayed back and met them at the terminus in Spokane this year. So I was mostly just social media. So I controlled the Instagram and Facebook that we have. And then a lot of fundraising, outreach, that type of thing goes to me. So anything, really anything that they need kind of gets delegated to me if they feel that I'm fit for the job.
And this is a question just for anyone. Who were you competing against? Who also tries to win this thing?
Definitely everybody.
Yeah. And, what schools?
We compete in the intercollegiate division. So we compete against other schools across the nation. But there's also a competitive division that is more for like anybody that's just looking to fly. They own a plane, they're renting a plane. It's all the teams are so, it's so diverse. You have people coming from all different age groups, backgrounds, stuff like that. But we compete in the intercollegiate category. So we competed, I believe it's 18 or 19 other colleges.
Give me an idea of who you beat. What are some of those losers? What schools are they from?
There's all the aviation, like there's Middle Tennessee, Auburn, Western Michigan, I'm trying to think of some other, Jacksonville, Prescott, Mankato. Yeah, there's a lot of teams out there.
I want to go around the room and ask each of you, why did you want to become a pilot? Helena, let me start with you. Why did you get into aviation?
Yeah, it was not really a dream until high school, I would say, for me. My mom was a United States Air Force Academy graduate, and she kind of sparked the whole idea of aviation to me. And from there, I started Civil Air Patrol. And then I was going to go to the military, but then I realized I wanted a traditional college experience. So I decided to go to UND, and I started my initial flight training here. And ever since I started, I can't imagine stopping it. So.
Charlotte?
So for me, it's a little bit different. I started very, very young. My dad is in the industry, and so I was exposed to the life of a pilot very young. So as soon as I knew I could pick a career, I was between that and a doctor. So I chose pilot for obvious reasons. It's the most rewarding career you could imagine. I started my flight training in my sophomore year of high school, and I got my private pilot's license as a senior in high school. And I loved it. It was so fun, the best experience. I love being hands-on. I'm very outdoorsy personality. I love to be hands-on. And so I cannot imagine doing anything else. So I came to University of North Dakota to continue that training and got my instrument, commercial, multi, CFI, CFII, and now I'm instructing too.
Caroline, what was your history? What was your journey?
So I was kind of similar to Helena in the fact that I didn't know at a young age that I wanted to be a pilot. I took a discovery flight in high school, and what inspired me to do that is I was, of course, at that age trying to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I knew that I wanted to always be like learning and growing throughout my career. And my dad mentioned offhandedly one day that if he had to do his career over again, he would choose to go the route of being a pilot. And so I kind of took that and made it my own, and now I'm here.
Aubrey?
So for me, I was a little bit of a mix between everybody. My dad is also in the industry, but at a young age, I wasn't sure that that's what I wanted to do. I really didn't have any interest at all as a young kid. And then COVID hit. For me, that was kind of at the end of my middle school years. And my dad had private pilot books laying around, just the dry like textbooks, all the fundamental concepts. And we started going through them. And I was like, hey, I really like this. Like, it's just the dry textbooks. And it was really interesting to me. It made sense. So I tried flying. And once I tried it, I was like, okay, I kind of have to do this. So then I started looking at aviation schools, and I ended up landing on here.
Take me back to the race. Did you have any challenges? Any things go wrong that you had to correct? Everything just went smooth. How did it go? Helena, you can lead this off as a pilot.
Sounds good. So we, throughout our route, there were mountains. And geography-wise, for North Dakota, it's very flat. So it was a very new experience for us. So I would definitely say the mountains were a little challenging, but still fun. It was very interesting to just be up at such a high altitude that our aircraft was first of all capable of, and then just also being in that competitive spirit, but still seeing such amazing views, is definitely a big idea that we had to play into going forth. We do have simulators at UND that we used for training purposes for this flight, for this race. So we did kind of see what altitudes we needed to be at. Kind of, we did a lot of training on density altitude because that's something that's it's a factor that heavily affects your plane's performance in the mountains. And especially in the hot summer days when the race takes place, we had to do a lot of learning with that topic specifically.
So I'm thinking in my mind, from Alabama to Spokane, are you going through about Colorado and Wyoming? Is that kind of about the areas that you're going through? So you're flying at least, you got to clear the mountains, 14,000 feet or so. I mean, probably a little higher than that.
Our service ceiling, so the highest our plane can go for its engine, is 14,000. So we were at about 10,800 was about the highest we ended up going.
So you're matriculating your route to avoid the big peaks. You didn't fly over any 14ers in Colorado then.
No, we didn't. Thankfully, the course did have a pretty clear-cut route through the mountains. They did. There are 2 stops in Wyoming and I believe 1 in Colorado. So they were taking into fact that we all have single engine airplanes and can only take us up so high.
Anyone else have any unique experiences that you encountered across the race?
I think another thing that we were introduced to that is not so normal for us is our school has limitations just like flight schools. So when the weather is in poor condition, it kind of takes away from making that own decision choice on when to go and when not to go. And for us, for the race, when the first leg was canceled, we had to deal with the storms and make our own decision if we can go, where we can go, and how we were going to go about getting to Boone County, Arkansas. And so that was a very new experience for us. And I think it was a really eye-opening experience. And it also taught us, all three of us, I know all of us can say for certain that it taught us a lot about CRM, and our CRM is crew resource management, and how to communicate and how to feel comfortable and make sure that our teammates feel comfortable to come to a decision together to get ourselves around the storms.
Caroline, you've now graduated. Is it any different for a woman in this field than it is for a man? Are you encountering?
I think the biggest thing that I've noticed is obviously there's significantly less women in this industry. What's really cool actually is this last freshman class of students at UND has our highest percentage of females ever, which is 20%, which is huge for us. But I think the biggest thing is just the fact that you kind of notice that you're often surrounded by guys. So when you meet women in the industry, there's a sense of camaraderie almost immediately because you're part of this smaller group.
Anyone else thought about that? 20% seems surprisingly a little bit low to me, but you're saying that it's not. It's kind of rising. Any challenges for you as a woman that you're either concerned about or have conquered?
I would say definitely representation. It's often when you're starting off young, it's hard to not see people who are like you excelling in this career. And it's sometimes it can kind of throw you off track a little bit. But I would say definitely UND has done great at having female flight instructors, professors, all types of support. I mean, we have women in aviation there. We have the 99s chapter. We have this air race team. So there's so much support and representation. But there are a few times where you do feel a little alone in the industry. But like Caroline had mentioned, the camaraderie is just amazing. You meet one woman in aviation, you're like, we're going to become best friends. So, yeah.
You're listening to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're talking with the UND Frozen Force team, fresh off their historic win in the Intercollegiate Air Race Classic. Why hasn't UND won before? What was special about your team, ladies?
I specifically think that the dynamic of the girls in this group made a big difference on our win this year. We were not very close before this race. I think we met kind of because of this race, and we came a really long way together, and I feel like we grew throughout the race, just like all things aviation, our personal minimums, our communication styles, learning about each other and learning about ourselves at the same time. That did a lot for us. And also we have their coaches who are so amazing and their impact on us and their influence and just really great role models for me specifically, Caroline and Helena and both the coaches and Aubrey too. I learned a lot from each one of them individually. And that also changed my personal skills and my ability, which I think I performed better because of the people I was surrounded by.
Tell me what the career path is for each of you, do you think? You're all, I believe, among other things, commercial aviation majors. So where do you see yourself in like a year or 5 years or 10 years? What does that career path look like? Are you each having to decide, I don't know, do I want to fly freight? Do I want to fly overseas? Do I want to fly domestic? A lot of those decisions coming your way?
Yeah, so graduating, coming soon, I am instructing. So I got hired at the University of North Dakota in January. So I will be instructing until I get enough hours to move forward. I want to go to the airline specifically because I've seen that career field and I really like the way it plays out. And being so young, as I'm only 20, I have to be 23 to be in a major airline. So I have a lot of time before. So I want to be in my seniority while I'm young. So the quicker I can get there, the better for me personally. So I'll be instructing at the university for about, I want to say a year and a half to get all my hours so that I can move forward. And then once I do that, I'm starting to look now for regional airlines that I can go to following here.
Helena or Caroline, same path for you?
I don't have a very specific path that I want to pursue. I just want to fly an aircraft wherever it takes me. The industry is kind of always changing. So I've never really been like, I need to go to the airlines or military or freight, stuff like that. I've been very interested into like private, like charter companies. I do like the dynamic through there because I did do a few internships with some companies. And I think that's just a very cool experience. You're kind of in your bed every night. So it's kind of something I've been intrigued to, but wherever the industry takes me, I can't complain. But as of right now, I am also a flight instructor at University of North Dakota. So I'll be here for about a year and a half to 2 years until I build some time.
And Caroline?
I'm not 100% sure where I want to go as far as companies and things like that. But what I do know is that with my second major in aviation safety and operations, that introduced me to flight data analytics. And so I'd like to combine that with my flying. So somehow, I don't know how it's all going to work out, but I'd like to do both in my career.
How has technology impacted what it is that you're planning to do? And I asked the question because of an interview that I had several years ago with a member of the Wyoming Senate, a legislator, who owned an air charter company in Wyoming. And he said, years down the road, there's going to be two things in the cockpit, a dog and the pilot. And the pilot's job is to feed the dog, and the dog's job is to bite the pilot if he touches anything, because it's all going to be autonomous. Are you worried that technology will make it more difficult for you, or is that just not going to be true?
I personally think that it's kind of hard to take people out at all completely, just because for safety reasons, there's so many lives at risk at one time that, yes, computers can do a lot, but they can't think on the spot. And that's also a lot of what we learned during our race. We didn't have any autopilot during our race. There was none in our aircraft. So we hand flew the whole thing. And there's a lot of things that the aircraft can do itself, but there's also a lot that it can't. And that's react to situations as they come up and be dynamic and change the plan and think critically on the spot. And so I think it's kind of hard to take that up for that reason, because without it, yes, the computer can hold a lot of things, but there's someone that needs to, in an emergency situation, make a decision. And I think that that's why it's kind of hard to just take all of it out. I do think there's probably a chance that it will be limited in some points, but I don't think it's possible to take them out completely.
Caroline, what were you planning to say?
I was going to say that I feel like being in this industry has taught us a lot of adaptability as pilots. And so I feel that wherever the industry grows, we'll be able to use that to adapt to whatever situation we find ourselves in.
The other thing that I'm curious about is we've heard just anecdotally that regional airlines just don't pay well enough and that they should pay more to keep people of your caliber. And it's hard to make money until you kind of work your way up, the seniority thing you were talking about, into larger airlines. Is that less true today than it was maybe 5 or 10 years ago?
I kind of think that that depends on the route that you take, where you start, when you start, what things are important to you, what things aren't important to you, based on your choice of where you want to go. I know from my dad's personal stories from when he was young, he was eating cup noodles, living out of hotel rooms. So it's definitely changed a little bit, because I know that's not the case so much anymore, but the industry is changing. And if you find the right route and you're happy, then I think that the payment comes after that. So I think wherever it is, it's so rewarding that you kind of get a little bit of both.
Helena, you may or may not be aware that some younger women, some younger girls may be listening to this. And what would you like to tell them about the career path that you've chosen?
To do it, if you want to pursue aviation and it is something that excites you, there should be nothing holding you back. It is something that is so achievable. It takes grit. It takes determination. It takes a dream to do it, but it's so worth it. The reward for everything is amazing. And just to also each step of the way, kind of like take a look back and see how far you've come. I know it's such a common thing to kind of get caught up in the studying and all of the stage checks and the flight lessons, but it's honestly such a great experience. And each step, each milestone is something that's just getting you closer to that dream that is now in this industry so achievable.
Let's go around the room and play a game of Mythbusters as we kind of wrap things up today. What's a myth that you would like to get out there about being a pilot that you've heard about that you want to just bust today?
That we are glorified bus drivers. That's a very common one. It's like the Airbus that we just kind of cart everyone around. There are a lot more factors that go into play. Yes, we kind of are the drivers of the sky, but there are a lot of things you are. There's a lot of people you're taking care of, a lot of factors going to play, like weather, routing, all that stuff. It's a very stressful but task saturated job, but it's worth it.
Charlotte?
I would say for all my friends that are not aviation, across country doesn't mean you're going across the country. In this race it did, but across country in aviation is just over 50 nautical miles. So when I used to tell my friends back in high school that I did across country in the morning, they would ask me how I got to California and back before 10 a.m. I didn't. I flew from Long Island to Connecticut. So it's only over 50 miles.
Caroline, how about you?
I don't know if this is a myth as much as it is just not well known. I would just say that the industry is so much bigger than people perceive it to be. A lot of times when you tell people that you're a pilot, they assume you're going to the airlines and that's the only option, but there's actually so much more to aviation than that. And then also the fact that when they asked me if I want to be a commercial pilot, I am a commercial pilot. I'm just not an airline pilot.
And Aubrey, what about you?
So the main big thing that I can think of, especially being a little bit younger and starting this, or I guess less experienced compared to everybody else, is just that you can start really anywhere and at any point. I know a lot of people are discouraged by starting later in life or not having family members in the industry. You can start at any point. You can go out to your local airport and do a discovery flight. I know a lot of people are discouraged by that. There have been people who, like friends of mine, who have come up to me and said, hey, how are you doing this pilot thing? I don't have any family or connections in the industry, but that's really cool. You can totally, it's achievable to anyone if you know where to look, and you can start with a discovery flight. So
what's the coolest plane anyone has piloted yet?
I flew an old V-tail Bonanza once. Sorry, Helena.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
It was kind of like my discovery flight. I didn't have a traditional go out to the airport and set it up at that airport. It was one of my family friends, and they have an old, I think it's a 76 Bonanza. So that was really cool. It's one of those fancy old looking planes, the nice red paint job and the V-tail. Really cool.
Anyone else?
UND, we have spin training for flight instructors. So all three of us, Charlotte, Caroline, and I all did our spin flights, and we have them in the decathlons or the Cessnas. So you pretty much go up in the air and do aerobatics and learn how to recover from them. So then if your student ever puts you in that situation, you know how to counteract. So yeah.
Caroline, what about you?
So I was also a member of UND's flying team, and through that I got the chance to fly one of three Cessna 150s. And the one in particular that I think is the coolest that I've flown was one of the first of the fleet that began the flight school at UND. So it's the oldest airplane in our fleet right now, which I think is really cool. It's like the second plane that was ever bought for UND's flight school.
Well, our thanks to the UND Frozen Force team for joining us today on Main Street and sharing their journey there from takeoff, or at least the initiation of the race in Alabama to Washington. They've now touched down as champions in Grand Forks. Did you get a big trophy?
We did, yes.
Well, congratulations.
And we got watches.
Nice. Very cool. Very nice. Well, congratulations from all of us here for sure. And best wishes to your futures.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, a North Dakota soldier longs for June berries, and century-old hydropower plants fight to stay online. That's all ahead
Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. From prairie groves to creekside thickets, few fruits have stirred such affection on the northern plains as the humble Juneberry. But beyond the pies and preserves lies a story of nostalgia, native roots, and just maybe a little frontier romance. As we hear in this episode of Plains Folk, historian Dr. Tom Ezern brings us a tale of wild fruit, settler longing, and young love blooming among the blossoms.
In late June 1898, a North Dakota boy, I suspect he was a serviceman en route to the Philippines, got homesick and wrote home to his mother in Jamestown. The question on his mind, are there lots of Juneberries at home? I would rather fall into a patch of Juneberries, chokecherries, or bullberries than to have all the tame fruit of California. Two things about this profession by a flicker tale far from home. First, the lad was declaring himself a son of the frontier where things are wild and expressing disdain for the refined, tame fruit in California's manicured orchards. Second, he spoke for the emerging settler consensus on the northern plains that wild fruit, especially Juneberries, was a good thing. Good for culinary use, yes, but more grandly, emblematic of a tie to the land and an emergent community thereon. We realize there was a possessive impulse in play here. Embracing native fruits intellectually was part of the dispossession of indigenous peoples, who consumed them, made pemmican with them, used their stems for arrow shafts, and in the case of Dakota and Lakota peoples, named a calendar moon for the Wipashuta. And it took a little while for the settlers to take to the Wipashuta, which they called Juneberry. Whereas settler newspapers of the late 19th century are full of notes about Juneberry picking, the first such mention I have located is from Emmons County on the 1st of July, 1887, when the country correspondent at Armstrong observed, "A great many are availing themselves of the opportunity now afforded to gather the luscious Juneberries along the creek." Now, the nomenclature. Outside of the northern plains, what we call the Juneberry is known as the American serviceberry. Moreover, in the Canadian provinces, it is proudly referred to as the Saskatoon. Neither of these names ever was current in North Dakota's settler society. Here, we have Juneberries, which seemed a bit odd, as Juneberries hardly ever fruited in June, a point I will examine later. Ordinarily, they were expected to be ready for picking in mid-July. The instance of 1st of July, cited from Armstrong, was rare indeed. Before composing this essay, I went out with our beagle dog to inspect the patch of Juneberries on our property, and it looks to me like they might be ready by the 4th of July, a date noted as remarkable in settlement days. Juneberries did, however, flower spectacularly in June. And so, although I know of no one else who is so asserted, I think it possible they were named for their month of efflorescence, a notable and welcome development. See, for instance, this fond note from Williams County on the 8th of June, 1899. "The coulees are all white with Juneberry, plum, and cherry blossoms." Ripening Juneberries drew covetous crowds from the prairie towns, writes the Hope Pioneer in mid-July 1890, "Large crowds of people, some country folk and some Hopeites, gathered daily along the banks of the Roaring Cheyenne to pick the prolific Juneberry, which is more plentiful this season than usual." From Glencoe, Emmons County, mid-July, 1898, "The whole country is up in arms over the Juneberry crop, and almost every man, woman, and child is in the timber gathering the big crop." Then this mention from Burleigh County in 1899. "Juneberries are ripe, and young folks are busy picking them." Is it my imagination that this report conveys a sense of young love?
Turns out Juneberries offered more than just sweetness for the table. they carried a taste of home, a sense of place, and perhaps a spark or two between pickers on a July afternoon. That was a Plainsfolk essay by Dr. Tom Ezern from North Dakota State University, where he's a distinguished professor of history.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in veteran and active duty home loans. Bill can be reached at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate change is making rural indigenous communities' efforts to receive quality health care more challenging. In Nevada, rising temperatures present a growing health risk. Stronger storms can also make traveling to get care difficult. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel reports that one tribe has found a solution, a doctor's office on wheels.
It's a clear morning in Lovelock, Nevada, a small desert town about 90 miles northeast of Reno. It's also home to the Lovelock Paiute Tribe, which has a 20-acre reservation on the edge of town. I'm at a tree-shaded park where the tribe is hosting its annual health fair. There's live music, jewelry vendors, information booths, and food trucks. There's also a vehicle that looks like a large blue and white motorhome, idling on the edge of the park. But inside are two patient rooms and a center lab with a blood draw station. It's a mobile health clinic brought here by the Fallon Paiute Shoshone tribe, located about an hour away. Gabriel Bourne just stepped out of the vehicle.
Having access to this, I was able to get some shots I needed, and you know that I should have probably had a long time ago, but didn't get.
Time and travel are the biggest barriers, he says. Bourne's a Fallon Paiute Shoshone member, but he lives in Lovelock, so seeing a physician in Fallon is a two-hour round trip. So when Bourne, who hadn't been to the doctor in more than a year, realized he was steps away from a mobile clinic, he took full advantage.
I'm able to get my eye appointment, which I've needed glasses for a while, along with some cancer screening setups and follow-up with the doctor to see labs and everything else.
Accessing quality health care has long been an issue for tribal nations, especially in rural areas. The Federal Indian Health Service has less than 100 hospitals and medical clinics nationwide, all to serve about 2.8 million American Indians and Alaska Natives. And most facilities suffer chronic staffing shortages. Some of the highest vacancy rates have been felt by the Navajo Nation, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Phoenix, Arizona, and Billings, Montana. John Pichon is the director of the Fallon Tribal Health Center, which runs the mobile clinic here at this fair. He says the lack of access was amplified 5 years ago during the COVID-19 pandemic.
A lot of health care facilities were being shut down, and with all the services being closed, we needed something to go out to the communities.
After years of driving their vehicles to neighboring reservations, the tribe bought a mobile clinic last year. It was funded by a $673,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, aimed at expanding rural health care access after the pandemic. The tribe's mobile clinic serves its members and drives to the Lovelock Paiute and Yamba Shoshone reservations, covering a territory of about 200 miles. It can also treat any member of a tribe in Nevada. Pichon says they serve about 2,000 people, averaging about 20 patients each month. They try to visit each tribe at least once a month, but that isn't always easy.
Challenges is weather and distance. They are far away, and during winter, sometimes these areas get a little hard to access.
Other tribal nations in our region are working to bridge the gap in healthcare access. Mobile health clinics are also being used by the Navajo Nation, the White Mountain Apache Tribe in Arizona, and the Fort Peck Tribes in Montana.
I think having the providers go into the community open their eyes to the needs and how to better serve them.
Dr. Christopher Chai is working at the mobile clinic here in Lovelock. He says they can even act as an urgent care for injuries and wounds.
We will get the random rancher come in with a broken finger and say, like, what do I do with this? Sliced open, and we can put in stitches.
Pichon adds that the clinic also helps tribal members be proactive instead of reactive about their health.
We have some people that maybe only come in when they're sick, but now they're seeing us for their preventative care when we come out.
Like Barbara Bonta, an elder of the Walker River Paiute Tribe who lives in Lovelock.
I've been seeing them for my feet and other problems that I didn't know I had until they start testing this and this and that.
Bonta was brought to the mobile clinic by her daughter, Tia Happy.
With my mom, she can't sit for a long time, you know, in a car to go to Fallon or elsewhere to appointments, so it makes it super convenient to have it here. when the mobile comes here.
Happy says her mom's been seeing Dr. Chai for the past 2 years. Consistent care that's been made possible by this mobile clinic, which isn't slowing down. This year, the clinic plans to add dental care to its services. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Radel.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Capital Shakespeare of Bismarck presents A Midsummer Night's Dream, a whimsical tale of love, mischief, and magic under the midsummer moon. Enjoy the production in the round, on the lawn, at their new location outside Sidney J. Lee Auditorium on the Bismarck State College campus. Performances start at 7 p.m. July 16th and run through July 20th, and are open to the public with free will donations accepted. Limited concessions available, lawn chairs or blankets are encouraged. More information at capitalshakespeare.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Now for a lighter story, giving the heaviness of news, fireflies. They're the flash mob of the insect world, putting on brief, tantalizing shows every summer. If fireflies were to disappear because of pesticide use or climate change, other creatures in their ecosystem may follow, so a team of scientists is working to conserve them by appealing to their romantic side. In This Week in Water, Franny Halperin has the enlightening story.
The clock is ticking for Georgia. She's got about a week to live and she needs to find a mate. How will she know when she's found Mr. Right? By his flashing light. That's because Georgia is a newly emerged firefly who was raised in captivity by researchers at Butterfly Pavilion, a zoo near Denver, Colorado. Now in an insect world version of the dating game or the bachelorette, she'll be introduced to five potential suitors who just days before were living in a wetland about an hour north near Fort Collins.
We're going to see them start going pretty soon once the sun dims.
That's Melanie Dodson, the zoo's animal well-being coordinator, who's been caring for the fireflies in the lab. I'm with her at a marsh filled with cattails and willows and punctuated with the songs of red-winged blackbirds as a team from the zoo prepares to collect males and females, which they'll later pair off in the hopes they'll mate. We've already seen a few fireflies, which are actually beetles, just hanging out at the base of some grasses in the wetland.
They're resting, getting ready to come and have that nuptial flight.
As the sun starts to set, the show begins. A few blinks here, a few blinks there, increasing every minute. And I know a few of you listening here in the state are as baffled as I was. We have fireflies in Colorado?
So most people associate fireflies to the East Coast or the eastern part of the United States, and we actually have them here in Colorado. I'm Francisco Garcia Bouye, and I'm the current Director of Research and Conservation at Butterfly Pavilion.
Bouye says little is understood about fireflies generally, and especially about the three species in Colorado that overwinter deep underground.
We started this program in 2017 because fireflies are just amazing. They're like an indicator species, which means that if an ecosystem starts changing, the first ones to be going or just declining or dying completely are going to be the fireflies. They're very sensitive to changes. So that makes them a very important species to be working with, because if they go, other species will follow.
He says the threats range from pesticide use to habitat loss and, unsurprisingly, light pollution, since the main reason the fireflies glow is to attract a mate.
Females have a flashing pattern, males have a flashing pattern, and that's what happens. Basically, you'll see it in the night. It's like this like big disco night, nightclub for them.
The flashing is not always about romance, though. They'll also use their pulses of light to warn of danger, and some have treachery in mind.
So some females will copy that pattern from another female, so she attracts boys from another species. What happens? She eats them. She's getting that extra protein. She's femme fatale. She's like tricking them. and then boom, she takes them down.
Intriguing behaviors like these can only be learned by studying the insects over time. The week before they came out to collect specimens, Georgia, the female firefly I mentioned waiting for her betrothed, emerged from her larval stage after 3 years at the zoo. Although she's only the fifth adult to pupate in their care, she's already helping them to learn more about Colorado's fireflies, such as what type of wetland soils they prefer and what they like to eat. Apparently, apples are a favorite, as are snails and slugs, and don't be fooled by larvae that are half the size of a grain of rice when they first hatch. They're fierce predators, able to poison and eat animals several times their size, which in the wild helps keep ecosystems in balance. That's just one benefit they provide to humans, so the team hopes that people, especially folks who might have phobias about bugs, will learn to appreciate them. Certainly, glowing like fairies helps to make them endearing.
I call them a gateway insect, just like honeybees or butterflies. It's a start for people to love things like mosquitoes or cockroaches or many other animals out there that might not be as charismatic.
Okay, here, ready. Francisco, ready?
Ready, yeah.
Go.
Yeah.
He's in.
Yeah. Let me count. Five.
Less than an hour after dark, Dodson has collected most of the fireflies she'll bring back to the lab. She's particularly stoked to find the one for Georgia.
Yeah, I feel like that's not like a mating flash. That's like a hey flash.
Hold on.
Yeah. Why'd you catch me? Because I'm going to get you a girlfriend.
For more females, I'm still a lot of males.
Given that insects are declining at an alarming rate worldwide, they say the worst case scenario is that their work will preserve the Colorado fireflies in captivity. A more optimistic view is that one day this wetland could be home to Georgia's great-great-great-grandchildren who will thrive because of the flashes of insight the research revealed. For H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. They've been running nonstop for over 100 years, but can hydropower survive Washington's deadlines and red tape? In this report from Harvest Public Media, we dive into the quiet workhorses of America's energy grid.
Inside the Sioux Hydroelectric Plant in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, 74 turbines are spinning and generating power for thousands of homes in the region. This narrow plant is a quarter mile long, and its red sandstone bricks harken back to the Gilded Age, when the plant first opened in 1902.
And it's been running pretty much 24/7, 365 since then.
Roger Lyon is with the Cloverland Electric Cooperative, the utility company that owns the plant today. He says Cloverland's considered shutting the facility down.
If you were to buy the same amount of energy out on the market today, you could probably get it a little cheaper.
In the end, Cloverland kept the plant open. It's not expensive to run and still generates a reliable flow of energy. But this back and forth isn't uncommon. A 2022 survey conducted by an engineering consulting firm found that about 36% of hydro operators in the U.S. were actively thinking about decommissioning their facilities. Unlike wind or solar projects, hydro facilities require a federal license that must be renewed every 50 or so years. And plants often have to deal with dozens of agencies. It can be a bureaucratic nightmare, according to Malcolm Wolf from the National Hydropower Association.
It takes, on average, almost 8 years to get an existing hydropower facility relicensed.
40% of the nation's hydro fleet that's not federally owned is facing license expirations in the next decade. The process, Wolf says, should be streamlined, but he says the hydro industry is facing another threat in the Big Beautiful Bill that passed the U.S. House in May. The legislation only offers tax credits for energy projects that can start construction quickly and go online by 2028. That doesn't line up with hydro's long permitting and construction timelines. And the bill also limits how operators can fund upgrades. Wolf says the draft Senate committee's version addresses these issues.
The House version would be a major threat to the industry. the Senate bill will make it a little bit easier to justify preserving the existing fleet.
Right now, hydro provides around 6% of the nation's electricity generation. Caitlin Grady is a civil engineer with the George Washington University. She says hydroelectric is important, especially if we want to cut down on emissions.
Without major changes in nuclear or hydro, we will not have a sustainable grid with just solar and wind unless we're also building a ton of batteries. And I mean tons and tons and tons of batteries.
Instead, Grady says grid reliability and energy output could be expanded by adding turbines to existing dams and investing in modern pumped storage technology that uses water and gravity as a battery. But century-old hydroelectric plants are still churning out power. At the Keokuk Renewable Center, which sits on the Mississippi River bordering Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois, operators say it's been business as usual since 1913. Brad Todd with Ameren says there's no plan to decommission Keokuk, which supplies electricity to 75,000 homes a year.
It's great for the customers, it's safe, it's efficient, and Ameren plans on keeping ours around basically forever if we can.
The plant has new turbines that are more energy efficient, because even as technology changes, the basic idea remains. Water keeps on moving. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Teresa Holmesey.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 8th. Leif Erikson led the first European expedition to North America around the year 1000. Many centuries passed before Scandinavians began arriving in the New World in large numbers. Norwegian immigrants were the first Scandinavians to settle in what is now North Dakota, arriving in Dakota Territory in 1869. Immigrants also came from Sweden, Finland, and Denmark, though in smaller numbers. Icelanders began arriving in the late 1870s. Pastor Paul Thorlaksson is considered the father of Icelandic settlement in the state. Serving a congregation in Wisconsin, he learned of the promising area around Pembina and encouraged the Icelanders in his flock to settle there. On this date in 1878, John Hulson proudly completed his cabin in what would become the community of Mountain in Dakota Territory. That modest cabin, built by one Icelandic immigrant, marked the beginning of what became the largest Icelandic settlement in the United States. By 1879, about 50 families had relocated to the area. Life was challenging for the settlers, and the first year was difficult. But by 1880, Thorlaksson felt the small community had turned a corner. He wrote, "At last there appeared to be good reason to believe our settlement would survive the coming winter, for several farmers had a fair crop that autumn. Some settlers had found work on nearby farms and returned after the harvest with money to support the community. New settlers also arrived from Manitoba." Today, North Dakota has the highest Icelandic population of any state. It also hosts the largest Icelandic gathering outside of Iceland, the Deuce of August, which celebrates Icelandic independence. On August 2, 1874, the King of Denmark granted a new constitution for Iceland, the first concrete step toward independence. A small group of Icelanders celebrated that day in 1874. Icelanders in Winnipeg held a celebration in 1890 calling it the Day of the Icelanders. While August 2 was never declared a national holiday in Iceland, it continues to be celebrated wherever Icelanders gather. Known as the Deuce of August, the largest celebration outside of Iceland takes place in Mountain, North Dakota. This year, the party is scheduled for August 1st through the 3rd. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And-
And that's it for this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll begin the first of our two-part tour of the Northern Plains Botanic Garden in Fargo that's transforming 6 acres at Yunker Farm Park into a vibrant community hub. We hope you have a great rest of your day, and we look forward to seeing you again tomorrow right here on Main Street.